In the early 80s, I played a modest role in a new play at a small fringe theatre. It was well received by the audience and got rave reviews. On the strength of these, an enterprising management transferred it intact to a theatre in the West End. I mention intact because this is unusual. More often than not, the leading players are replaced by stars calculated to attract the public in larger numbers. But since our leads were so well cast and were praised so highly by the critics, it was decided to present the play in Shaftesbury Avenue exactly as it had been on its premiere. I was quite bucked, of course, because I'd gambled by playing but peanuts, and now I was set to receive a substantial reward if the piece had a long run. Unfortunately, things didn't work out quite like that. The self-same critics who came to the West End opening went back on their previous verdicts and described the play as slight, a word more damning than rotten or stinking. It was depressing for all concerned that these gentlemen of the press, who had enjoyed the play when sitting on hard benches in an unventilated cellar, should like it so much less when they were sitting in plush stalls in an airy and attractive theatre on Shaftesbury Avenue. Of course, they'd all seen it before, which robbed it of surprise, and they knew the best jokes. Indeed, it printed many of them in their reviews, so a good proportion of the audience knew them as well. The show closed after the second week, and instead of having a good income for 6 months or a year, I found myself unexpectedly vacant, the euphemism used by advertisers in the trade paper when they're seeking employment. I'd been riding high, and now I was down again. It was a real yo-yo of a year for me. I discussed my situation with a few friends, but they came out with the usual excuse that things were very quiet for everybody. One or two offered advice. I remember one in particular. He'd spent the best years of his life in a long-running radio serial, and had married and brought up 3 children on the proceeds. He told me that Selfridges needed someone to demonstrate a new type of vegetable grater. I didn't reply. I hoped my silence would indicate my feelings, but he was too thick to get the message. He went on, "If you took that on, Jacko, you'd be very well placed to slip into the role of Father Christmas, which they begin casting in October." "Thank you, Bertram," I said, "but I think I must remind you I have played some distinguished roles in a very long career." He didn't seem to take this in. "What about a job as guide on coach tours of London?" "No," I said, "I'm thinking along the lines of something like I have done for 40 years, acting, directing, producing, managing, cabaret, television, film, stage plays, radio. Do you get the picture?" "Of course I do, Jacko, but I don't think you should turn your nose up at working on sightseeing coaches. A lot of well-known actors are pleased to do it. Who, for instance?" "Well-known actors. I can't think of their names at the moment. Alec Guinness, Peter O'Toole." "Don't be ridiculous." "Well, you said well-known." "You're impossible sometimes, Jacko." "Possibly. But in exchange for the advice you've given me, Bertram, here's a bit of advice for you. Get out of that radio serial while you still have your health and strength, because if you stay in it for another 20 years, as seems likely, you'll be ready to play Father Christmas yourself, and you won't need makeup. Cheerio for the moment." And I hung up. I sat there for a moment or two, remembering this friend as he was as a young man, before he succumbed to the lure of a steady income and regular work week after week for what should have been the best years of his life. Then the phone rang. Up went the yo-yo. It was an offer to tour with an all-star production of an old four-hander. As soon as I'd expressed interest, the management revealed that the stars referred to were all in TV soaps, and although their names would appear above the title, the names of the characters they played and the names of their shows would be in brackets underneath. Otherwise, no one would know who they were. But financially, it was a good bet for me, and on signing, I did something I have never done before. I let my flat. I thought the income would pay for my accommodation in Eastbourne, Torquay, and the dates up north. I found a tenant through an acquaintance, and he seemed pleasant enough. Flynn, a children's entertainer who was based in Leeds but who wanted to try his luck in London. He took the flat for 6 weeks. I arranged to stay with a friend for a few days before we left town, and he moved in straight away, with his puppet theatre, conjuring gear and a ventriloquist's dummy. all seemed to point to a revival of my fortunes when fate pulled the rug from under me. The tour was cancelled. The four stars, whose names no one knew, could not agree about the billing. They actually came to blows. The two women, that is, the two men contented themselves by merely shouting abuse. So this left me not merely out of work, but out of my home. I went to see Flynn and put it to him that I needed to move back. He was unsympathetic and insisted on staying. I was annoyed to see that he'd turned my furniture round and had left the remains of a lavish Indian takeaway meal on the coffee table. I noticed several grains of rice on the rug. I mentioned that this was a genuine Bhopal and he should take care of it. He made some appalling joke about it being an Indian rug and used to a bit of curry being spilled on it. I did my best to persuade him to find another place, even offered to help, but he was adamant. I appealed to him as a human being, as a fellow performer, and said at least he had a roof over his head in Leeds, but I was literally homeless. He as good as said that was my own silly fault. Fortunately, I had several friends who offered me temporary accommodation. Some were very well connected and had rooms to spare, but I never felt I could take advantage of their hospitality for more than a day or two. I felt like a criminal on the run. And, of course, it became difficult to negotiate with managements and agents when my phone number was constantly changing. One day, walking along the King's Road with two heavy suitcases, my spirits were at a particularly low ebb. I paused to watch a sightseeing coach go past as the guide, microphone in hand, described the scene to Japanese tourists who were too busy with their cameras to listen. I remembered the friend who'd upset me by suggesting it was a job I might do. Never, I thought to myself, I can never quit show business. And then I caught the word coach as the said vehicle moved on towards Sloane Square. Coaching, I thought. That's something I've considered doing in the past, having been asked to do so by impressed youngsters. Yes, I think I'll give it a try. True, I didn't have a degree from any drama school, but on the other hand, I had a wealth of varied experience in every facet of show business. It was only a question of getting started. I'd seen cards in newsagents' windows, but they were usually rubbing shoulders with other cards offering French lessons and coaching by strict disciplinarians. No, I thought I need to put an advert in the professional organ. I spent some time working it out, and eventually, after much rewriting, I settled on J. Kingston Platt of London, New York, Hollywood and Rome can accept a few selected pupils for coaching in every aspect of theatrical art. Please write to secretary for interview. I had a postcard-size ad, and when it came out on Thursday morning, I thought it looked quite impressive. I looked forward to the next morning's mail so that I could start selecting the lucky few. I received two letters. One was a carbon copy of a circular advising me to continue the good luck chain started by a Burmese water diviner in 1942. I thought 40 years was long enough to perpetuate this kind of folly and passed on to the other letter. It was much more interesting. A youth in Birmingham wanted help in getting started on the stage. He wrote that he'd tried the registered drama schools but had been turned down several times. Although he lived far from London, he'd be willing to come down on his motorbike if I could take him on. He mentioned his shy and retiring manner and said he hoped I'd be able to give him confidence. I got him on the phone later that day and explained that my secretary had passed his letter on to me because she thought it was particularly interesting. I'd put his name at the top of a long waiting list of hopefuls. I arranged to meet him the following day at the Savoy Hotel. I've often used this venue for meetings in the past, and it has much to recommend it. It's large and airy, the name never fails to impress, and if I'm ever questioned by staff as to why I'm sitting there, I merely reply, I'm waiting for Lord Ebury. That always satisfies them. So the following afternoon at 2:00, I'm sitting on one of their comfortable chairs reading a Financial Times left by a previous occupant. I watched the entrance, and very punctually, a thin, nervous youth of about 20 appeared at the main entrance, looking very furtive. So furtive, in fact, that he invited a charge of behaving in a suspicious manner. I'd given him a brief description of myself, but I saw him glance in my direction without any sign of recognition. So I think I may have painted a too flattering picture. I decided to risk it and went over and greeted him. Mr. Arkwright, I presume? He jumped out of his skin. That's right, Mr. Kingston Platt, right? Right. I explained that I'd finished my business at the hotel and suggested we chat as we walk over to the theatre where I'd arranged to audition him. He asked me how far it was and offered to give me a lift on his motorbike. This was parked outside and the commissionaire was fuming about it holding up the taxis and chauffeur-driven cars sweeping up to the entrance. I explained that the boy's father, Lord Ebury, had given him the machine and he was childishly proud of it. The commissionaire bent almost double as he stepped back 6 feet. Having found a suitable parking place in a street on the other side of the Strand, we strolled in the direction of Shaftesbury Avenue to a theatre where I'd already arranged for an old stage doorkeeper friend to use the stage for a brief period. I have to admit I was disappointed to find Hector a very poor conversationalist. All he could do, it seemed, was to keep repeating that he was sure he could act if he was given a chance. But he displayed none of the characteristics of the performer. He wasn't outgoing. He mumbled. He didn't use facial expression or gestures to express himself. On the strength of his offstage manner and personality, I gave him zero chance of ever making it. The audition confirmed my opinion. He walked onto the stage as if it were made of very thin ice. He spoke quietly, as if afraid of his voice detonating an explosive device. I had with me copies of Private Lives and Julius Caesar. He read the opening scene of Coward's Classic with me playing Amanda. I can see that this was no help to Hector Arkwright. But even so, his grasp of delivering lines was abysmal. Afterwards, we played the Cassius Brutus tent scene, and he floundered hopelessly. We switched parts, but he was no better. And he had the physical attributes, lean and hungry, etc., but no theatrical flair, no instinct for effect. We chatted over a cup of tea later in a greasy spoon. I no longer felt any need to impress him. I explained that I could not offer very much hope of him ever having a career in showbiz. But then I remembered that my main reason for getting involved was the need to boost my income. I think I was very fair. "I can't offer to do miracles," I said. "But there is a chance that if I work on your voice and posture, you will appear more self-assured. Let's start off with 6 lessons at £10 each." He agreed and seemed pathetically grateful. "You do honestly think I have something, then?" he asked in that tentative monotone which I decided was the first thing I must get rid of. "Let's say you're worth investigating further," I replied enigmatically. He rode off to Birmingham, and I looked around for somewhere I could use for the lessons. I had no other applicants, by the way. Hector Arkwright was my sole pupil. Eventually, I persuaded a musician I knew to let me have his Islington studio for 1 hour a week for £2. I'd expected him to let me have it gratis, but he was outraged when I suggested that. He argued that I was getting paid for the lessons, and he was entitled to remuneration for the accommodation. I put it to him that £2 an hour came to over £300 a week. He said if I wanted it for that long, he would make a reduction. Musicians have been tough negotiators ever since talkies came in, so I agreed to pay. The first lesson went reasonably well, but it was hard work getting Hector to loosen up. I didn't see much hope, really. But he was a pleasant lad, and I wanted to help him. The second lesson, a week later, was fixed for the same time, 2 o'clock in the afternoon. I was a bit put out when he hadn't arrived by 4:15. I looked out of the window at the orderly Georgian houses and wondered if my musician friend would charge me extra. No sign of a motorbike, but a Daimler Sovereign pulled up outside and a burly man got out and looked up at the building and at me in the window. He moved towards the front door and the entry phone rang. I answered it and a voice inquired if I was Platt. "J. Kingston Platt," I said. "My name's Arkwright, Mr. Platt. I shan't keep you long." I pressed the button and listened to him puffing his way upstairs. I waited with the door open. He handed me a card which read, "John Arkwright and Company." Apart from realizing that this must be Hector's father, what intrigued me most about the card was the business in which the company was involved: locks, chains, and prison requisites. "As you have no doubt guessed, I am Hector's father. Shall we talk here, or are you going to invite me in?" he inquired aggressively. "Of course, please. He came in, looked round, and just as I was about to invite him to sit down, he sat down, in the only comfortable chair in the room. He wiped his perspiring forehead. He didn't waste any time in getting down to the reason for his visit. "It's none of my business why you're taking money from my son and encouraging him in this lunatic idea of becoming an actor, but you must know as well as I do there is no hope of him making a living in show business. Even if I gave him permission and actually financed him, which I have no intention of doing, by the way. But I'm a fair man. I realise that he owes you £50 for the next 5 lessons, and I don't want you to feel hard done by, even if you deserve it." He took an envelope out of his right inside pocket. 50 in fivers. No more lessons, and it's all yours." I opened my mouth to protest. He didn't give me a chance. "There is one condition. You will be here next week when he turns up for his lesson. You will explain to him that it's all been a mistake, that in your opinion he is without any acting ability, and no amount of lessons will ever show him that he has any. Tell him to get into a good, sound business. Did he ever tell you about Arkwright and Company, by the way?" "No, no, he did. Pity. You won't be able to tell him to stick with me without him knowing I've talked to you. Never mind. If you do your job correctly and pour cold water on his ludicrous ambitions, that will be enough. Hopefully he will see sense and come back to the fold. The business has increased turnover and profits every year since 1942, and we are in for a huge boom in sales in the Middle East as soon as the Americans leave, right?" He held out the envelope. "I'm sorry, I couldn't possibly." "You couldn't, eh? Well, I anticipated that you might try and squeeze the lemon, so I brought another envelope with a like amount." He took a similar envelope out of his left-hand inside pocket. "You accept this, and you're making a ton for doing nothing." I stared back at him, my lips no doubt in the thin line that denotes grim determination. He nodded as though his expectations had been realized. "So you've decided to be greedy, eh?" "No," I said, "I simply do not want your money. Whether your son has talent or not remains to be seen, but I will not be a party to a conspiracy aimed at persuading him to give up." He leered. "Every man has his price." "I've heard that before," I said. "But if you think mine is £100 in dirty fivers, then you are mistaken. Why, I've earned more than that in a few seconds doing TV commercials. And even if you start throwing 4 figures in my direction, I shall still refuse. It's a matter of principle." He changed his tack. "It's for the boy's own good. What kind of life will he have as a jobbing actor? Why, he could have a share in the family business in a year or two and take over entirely when I call it a day. Make no mistake about it, our business is on the threshold of an unprecedented boom. We have the most advanced system of electronic tagging in Europe. And when prisons are privatized in this country, which is only a matter of a few years, we are ideally placed. We have a Member of Parliament on our board, and things have never looked so good. All this could be my son's. Would anyone who wished him well prefer him to be touring the country in tacky little companies, playing butlers, perhaps even corpses? Why, he might even end up as a chorus boy, with all the personal dangers that that implies. No, Mr. Platt, I do not believe that you could ever willfully ruin a young man's life by refusing to tell him an unpalatable truth. I'm sorry I insulted you by offering money. I should have known better. It's a result of dealing with so many foreign buyers. Kickbacks, you understand. But I can see that you are a man who would not be influenced by sweeteners of that sort. So I appeal to you as a fellow Englishman. Will you tell my boy the facts?" He stuffed the money back into his pockets. "When he comes to see me, I'll have a frank talk with him. Leave it to me, Mr. Arkwright." This pleased him, and I was very relieved. Of course it was a get-out as far as I was concerned, but it enabled me to end the interview without injury to my person, because Mr. Arkwright seemed the sort of man who'd not stop at physical assault. And although not comparable in size to my Irish tenant, I dare say he was probably the more useful, as they say, in a brawl. So I shook hands with him, and off he went, perfectly happy, and convinced that I was going to do exactly what he wanted. And my conscience was clear because I'd merely promised to talk to Hector. I hadn't mentioned persuading him to give up his histrionic ambitions. So next week, when Hector arrived, I asked him to sit down and told him, more or less word for word, what had passed between his father and myself. Poor lad, he was knocked out. "He was willing to pay you?" he asked incredulously. £100. I think he might well have gone higher if I'd not left him in any doubt about my integrity. He seemed unable to speak. He walked about shaking his fists and now and then punching the air. "I'll show him," he muttered through clenched teeth. "I'll show him." I waited for an appropriate moment and suggested that while he was in the mood, we might have another go at the tent scene. He almost snatched the book from me. "Right, let's go." "I'll show him," he repeated once more before he began. Carrying his outrage and anger against his father into his interpretation of Cassius produced a really sensational read. In a way, it was a sort of method performance by accident. But it could not have worked better if he'd spent years with Lee Strasberg. In fact, his powerful delivery reminded me forcibly of the young Brando. I was so transfixed that I almost threw away my own interpretation of Brutus. But it made no difference to Hector. He was possessed. Not merely vocally, but completely. His eyes flashed and every muscle of his body helped to communicate Cassius's feelings. If the casting directors of the Royal Shakespeare Company had been there, they would have signed him up on the spot. I felt quite smug at the end of the lesson, and several times during the following week I congratulated myself on holding my ground with the lad's father. I actually looked forward to our next meeting and had in mind trying him out with a scene or two from Streetcar. I was all ready at the appointed time, and after 10 minutes I started to worry. I wondered if perhaps his appalling father had talked him out of following his natural bent. After another 10 minutes or so, a taxi drew up outside. I was standing by the window, and I was disappointed to see an Arab in flowing robes emerge, tip the driver, and approach the front door. Then the entry phone rang, and a guttural voice asked to be admitted. I explained that the owner of the flat was not at home, but he said that didn't matter. I was rather hesitant about admitting him, but did so mostly because I couldn't think of any reason I could give for not doing so. Seconds later, I opened the door to this wild-eyed man with discoloured teeth and a nasty-looking curved dagger in his belt. He didn't wait for me to invite him in, just pushed past me and turned. After bowing with his hands together, he glared at me with eyes narrowed by years of exposure to the desert sun and inquired if I was Mr. Platt, the great teacher. A bit rich, I thought, but I couldn't think of an appropriate reply. Before I could say anything, he seemed to relax and his face broke into a familiar smile. "Jacko, you really didn't recognize me." It was my pupil, Hector. He gave me a big hug and sat down, laughing. I assumed at first that he was happy because he'd fooled me. It proved beyond doubt that he possessed a great gift for character acting. But there was more to it than that. The explanation came out in bursts, interrupted by much laughing and giggling. He'd just come from a casting session for a new mini-TV series. He'd read they were looking for an Arab actor to play the villain in a sex and sand epic to be filmed in North Africa. They couldn't find a genuine Arab who was uninhibited enough to project the evil side of the character, or was unpatriotic enough to do so. Anyway, young Hector borrowed an authentic outfit from a customer of his father's, complete with the ugly dagger. He darkened his teeth with charcoal biscuits and went along to the casting session without an appointment. But he intimidated the secretary in the outer office into letting him go past and stormed into the meeting where director and producer were interviewing a mild-mannered Syrian who wore a several-row suit and spoke with an Oxford accent. Hector said he called him a dog and ordered him out of the room, brandishing the dagger. Off went the Syrian, and the others cowered in a corner, believing they were at the mercy of a psychopath. It was then he turned on the smarm, begged their forgiveness and told them he'd paid his own fare from Cairo, where he'd been a drama student at the university and knew of no other way to obtain an audition. The long and short of it was, they gave him the part. He was due to start work in 3 weeks' time. It was a heartwarming ruse, one that every actor has dreamt of pulling off at some time or other. And the endearing part of it was, Hector said it was all due to me for giving him confidence in himself. I made a few modest protests, of course, but he was adamant. All due to me. How could he ever repay me, he asked. Well, his success was reward enough, I said. He shook my hand vigorously. Then he looked at his watch and explained that he had to go for a costume fitting, the Harrod's riding habit that the villain wore when he attempted to violate the English heroine. He said he'd have to take a taxi and asked if he could drop me at my flat. On the way downstairs, I told him I was not going there, due to Flynn, the immovable children's entertainer. "I can move him," he said. And with that, he bundled me into a taxi, and off we went to the home I'd so mistakenly rented. He hammered on the door and produced the dagger. Flynn came to the door. I stood behind Hector, who wasted no time. He grabbed Flynn's shirt with both hands and hissed into his face. "You have taken my brother's tent, and you have defiled his property. You have 5 minutes to get out." A very frightened Flynn appealed to me. "You can't do this." Hector pushed him away and grabbed his ventriloquist's dummy. With one blow from the dagger, he beheaded it. The head rolled on the floor, the mouth gaping open in a macabre imitation of an executed human. All right," said Flynn, "I'll go. Just give me time to get my things together. But mark my words, you haven't heard the last of this." 4 minutes," growled Hector, "and hurry. The caravan does not wait for the slowest camel." And within the 4 minutes, Hector allowed, Flynn was outside on the pavement, his baggage and gear around him. We watched him hail a taxi and stow the stuff away. The driver gave him an old-fashioned look when he picked up the decapitated dummy. Hector left after thanking me once again. He shook hands and off he went to start his brilliant career. The yo-yo ascended once again. If I told you the name Hector Arkwright chose to use professionally, you probably wouldn't believe it. But you would certainly know it.